Two best friends vanish during a winter hike in small-town Indiana. A single Snapchat photo and a chilling audio clip, down the hill, are the only clues left behind. For 5 years, the town spirals into obsession, paranoia, and grief. And when the killer is finally found hiding in plain sight, the truth is far more disturbing than anyone imagined. This is not just a story about murder. It's about the mask of normalcy and what happens when it slips. Are you ready to hear the voice that haunted a nation? Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, Snapchat Clue Leads to Killer. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Hike. They say some moments mark the end of innocence. In Delphi, Indiana, ours ended on a cold, overcast Monday, February 13, 2017. I remember that date not because I covered it in the news, or because it plastered itself on crime forums for years after. I remember it because it's the day everything changed. The day two bright, beautiful teenage girls walked into the woods and never came out. The day the illusion of safety died. I grew up in this town, population under 3,000. Everyone knew everyone. We had a single grocery store, one blinking red light, and a community center that doubled as a polling station and bingo hall. It was the kind of place you passed through, not to. No one locked their doors. Kids rode bikes without helmets. The most scandalous thing to hit our local Facebook group before that week was a raccoon breaking into someone's trash. Then came Libby and Abby, Liberty German and Abigail Williams, just 15 and 13, thick as thieves. If you lived in Delphi, you knew them, or at least knew someone who did. They were the kind of girls who made you laugh without trying. Smart, strong-willed, and always posting something goofy on Snapchat. They had this friendship that felt like magic, like sisterhood in its purest form. They walked through life side by side, from elementary school classrooms to volleyball practice to late-night texts about crushes and classes and music. That day was a Monday off, some kind of teacher work day. They wanted to spend it together, outdoors, being teenagers. Libby's older sister Kelsey dropped them off near the Monon High Bridge trailhead around 1:30 p.m. The bridge itself was an old rail trestle, long abandoned but photogenic as hell, towering over Deer Creek with no railings, just narrow wooden planks stretching into the horizon like a dare. That kind of place was tailor-made for Snapchat. And sure enough, at 2:07 p.m., Libby posted a picture to her story. It's the kind of image that burns itself into your mind the longer you look at it. Abby's walking ahead of her, carefully balancing on the narrow boards. Her hair is tied up, her jacket zipped tight. The trees are bare, skeletal things. There's a grayness to the light, like the sky itself was holding its breath. That picture is the last visual proof they were alive. The hours that followed? A blur, but one I've replayed 1,000 times in my head. When the girls didn't show up at the pickup spot around 5:30, their families called it in fast. Cops showed up, but at first it was treated like a routine search. Teenagers gone exploring, probably lost or hiding, maybe phones died. But there was something off, something in the air. The woods weren't just quiet that night, they were still. Like even the animals knew to stay away. I joined the first search wave with my recorder and notebook in my coat pocket, still thinking I was just there to write a feel-good story about a search party gone right. But by midnight, that hope started slipping. Flashlights darted through the darkness like fireflies, but they found nothing. No footprints. No phone. No girls. Only dread, thick and rising like fog off the creek. The next morning, the mood shifted hard. We weren't looking for two missing kids anymore. We were looking for something worse. A volunteer found them just before 12:30 p.m. in a wooded area off the trail, not far from the creek. The details were never made public, not fully, but the police confirmed what we all feared. Both girls were dead. Homicide. Double. I won't describe the scene. Not just because I wasn't there, though I wasn't, but because the fragments I did hear were enough to keep me up at night for the rest of my life. There were signs of staging, we heard. Signs that the killer wanted it to be seen. And yet, he'd left behind almost nothing. Almost. Then the break, the phone. Libby, in those last terrifying moments, had the courage, no, the instinct, to pull out her phone and hit record. Not video, just audio. I get chills every time I think about that. She knew something was wrong. Maybe she saw him first. Maybe she just felt it. But she pressed record, and that decision changed everything. The recording, short, grainy, but chilling, played for the public a few days later. The FBI and Indiana State Police wanted help identifying the voice. They played it at press conferences, over radio, and interviews. Two words, spoken calmly, like a command from the devil himself. Down the hill. The tone was low, steady. Not rushed. Not angry. Like he'd done it before. Or at least planned it. We all heard that voice. Over and over. I played it so many times that it became part of my subconscious. I'd be pouring coffee and hear it whisper behind me. I'd dream about it. Sometimes I'd swear it sounded like someone I knew. Other times, it felt completely alien. But the thing that really shattered us? No arrest. Not that week. Not that month. Not that year. Flyers covered gas station windows. Murals went up at the elementary school. Online sleuths flooded Reddit threads and YouTube rabbit holes. I started my own podcast about it. Small town reporter turned true crime junkie. I couldn't help myself. Every clue, every theory, every pixel of that grainy Snapchat photo. I tore it all apart like my life depended on it. Because in some fucked up way, it did. I didn't know it yet, but that photo and that voice would haunt me for the next 5 years. I'd lose my grip on what was real and what wasn't. I'd ruin my marriage, burn bridges, lose friends. All because of two words. Down the hill. Chapter 2, The Obsession. You know how people talk about falling down rabbit holes? That's too gentle of a phrase for what happened to me. This wasn't a fall. It was a slow, choking descent, like being pulled down inch by inch into something dark and thick and inescapable, like quicksand made of grief and obsession. After the recording was released, those two words, down the hill, Delphi changed. I changed, and not in the poetic, coming-of-age kind of way. No, I changed like food rotting in a fridge. Silent, decaying, invisible at first, but eventually, you open the door and the smell hits you like a punch to the gut. That was me. I couldn't let it go. The police were tight-lipped. Understandably so. They said they had suspects. That they were working the leads. That justice takes time. But days turned into weeks. Then months. Then years. And still nothing. Meanwhile, I spiraled. I wasn't just a reporter anymore. I was in it. I mean, all in. I spent my nights digging through forums, web sleuths, Reddit, Facebook groups with names like Justice for Abby and Libby and Solve Delphi Now. I joined them all. Posted under aliases at first, then just as myself. I didn't care who saw. I wasn't chasing a byline. I was chasing a ghost. I set up a wall in my garage, like something out of a bad detective movie. Photos. Maps. String connecting grainy screenshots to timelines, to names, to theories. I played the audio so often that my wife begged me to stop. I didn't. Instead, I bought noise-canceling headphones and just turned the volume up louder. My wife, Sarah, she tried. God bless her, she tried. But how do you compete with a phantom? How do you argue with a voice that's not yours but lives in your house, whispering, down the hill, into your ears while you sleep? Eventually, she stopped asking me to come to bed. Eventually, she stopped asking anything at all. I didn't even notice when she left. She packed her things one afternoon while I was listening to an old episode of a podcast analyzing the inflection of the killer's voice. I didn't hear the door close. I only noticed when I went to ask her something about dinner and saw the closet half empty. She left a note. Not a goodbye, just a line. I hope you find peace, but you're not taking me with you into that darkness. I should have chased her. Should have stopped. But I didn't. Because by then, I'd convinced myself I was the only one really looking. The police were too cautious. The town too afraid. And the rest of the world. They moved on. But me? I was stuck. Somewhere between that bridge and the creek. Between Libby's camera flash and that audio recording. I wasn't living in 2020. I was still frozen in 2017, in the woods, with two teenage girls and a voice I couldn't stop hearing. You want to know what obsession looks like? It looks like cold pizza boxes stacked like paperwork. Like unpaid bills piled on top of crime scene printouts. Like a toothbrush unused for 3 days because you've been up scouring satellite images of the trail from 2016, hoping maybe, just maybe, you'll find something everyone else missed. It looks like me driving 2 hours to an abandoned building just because someone on Reddit said a man in a hoodie matching the Delphi composite sketch used to work there back in 2014. It looks like getting thrown out of a bar for confronting a man who looked too much like the sketch. Like staring into your neighbor's eyes, just a little too long. Like flinching when the mailman speaks. It's a disease. an infection of the mind, and I was terminal. I started emailing detectives with theories. They stopped replying. I sent anonymous letters to people I suspected, some of whom were just local weirdos, not actual threats. I crossed lines. I broke laws. I didn't care. All I cared about was this nagging thought, this whisper that never shut up. He's still out there. And that terrified me more than anything. Because if he was still walking around, still living in plain sight, then who else was watching our daughters? Who else was lurking behind smiles and neighborhood barbecues and PDA meetings? I began interviewing locals for my podcast, people who had been on the trails that day. Witnesses who saw a guy, but couldn't remember specifics. A woman who swore she saw a muddy man climbing a bank near Deer Creek. An old man who said his trail cam picked up movement just after 2:30 p.m., but the footage had been accidentally deleted. They all became chapters in my descent. Names I scribbled on napkins. Voices that echoed in my head long after the interviews ended. And then there was the sketch, the infamous police sketch released in 2019. A total change from the first one. Younger. Sharper features. More confident. A reversal, almost. Like the killer was mocking us, aging in reverse, hiding behind evolving identities. But when the second sketch dropped, something snapped in me. That's when I knew he wanted to be caught. He just didn't want to make it easy. And if the cops couldn't see that, maybe I could. Maybe it was my job to be the monster hunter Delphi never asked for. Or maybe I was just losing my mind, one snap-filtered clue at a time. But I couldn't stop. I wouldn't stop. Not until I dragged the truth out of whatever dark corner it was hiding in. Even if it meant tearing apart my own life in the process. Chapter 3. The Mask of Normalcy. There's a kind of horror that doesn't arrive with a scream or a flash of violence. It creeps in on a whisper. It sits next to you in church. It bags your groceries. It waves at your kid from across the street. And for 5 goddamn years, we lived with that horror, smiled at it, invited it into our homes, never knowing it had blood under its fingernails. Delphi had convinced itself that the killer had left town, that whoever slaughtered Abby and Libby must have fled, hiding in some backwoods shack or underground lair in another state. Something far. Something foreign. It was easier to believe that than the truth, that evil had been living among us the whole damn time. It wasn't a sudden realization. It was a slow thaw. I remember the exact moment that shook the first crack loose in the ice. It was spring, 2021. I was walking my dog along a back path behind the CVS. It was one of those rare days where it almost felt like things were normal again. The sun was out. Kids were biking around. And for a few minutes, I actually stopped hearing that voice in my head. Down the hill. And then I saw him. Standing beside a rusted old pickup, watching a crew of kids toss a football in the parking lot. He wasn't doing anything strange. No creepy leer. No trench coat or ski mask. He was just standing there. A little too still. A little too quiet. It was Rick. Richard Allen. Local guy. CVS employee. Married. No criminal record. Known to most just as the photo guy. The kind of man who printed your family's Christmas cards or sold you toothpaste while asking how your kid's baseball team was doing. We'd crossed paths before, casually. He helped my wife once when she needed a passport photo for work. Always friendly. Always helpful. Just enough charm to be forgettable. But that day, something in my gut stirred. I didn't know why. Not yet. Just something about the way he stood there, watching those kids, triggered a rusted part of my brain. And I remember thinking, that guy looks like the sketch. The second sketch. The one they released in 2019 that confused the hell out of everyone. Younger. Narrow face. Curved jaw. Smug. Yeah. Rick looked just enough like him that it lit a fuse in my chest. But I told myself to chill. I'd gone down too many wrong roads before. Too many dead ends. I'd accused the mailman once, for fuck's sake. But that feeling, it lingered. A few weeks later, I went back. Same trail. Same time. Just to see. And sure enough, there he was again. Same truck. Same casual stance. Like clockwork. So I started digging. I found out Rick had worked at the CVS since 2006. Lived just a few miles away. No online presence to speak of. His wife, Kathy, taught piano out of their home. They kept to themselves. But here's the thing. Rick had been working the day the girls were murdered. Right there at the store. Same store where the victims' families picked up prescriptions. same store where the flyers were handed out, where the composite sketches sat on the community board. He'd seen them every day, and no one looked at him twice. It was a perfect hiding place, in plain sight. I started asking quiet questions around town. Anyone remember if Rick was off the day of the murders? Did he ever talk about the case? No one had anything solid. But one guy, Joe, an old high school buddy who worked the registers, told me Rick had taken a long lunch that day. Said it was weird, because Rick wasn't the type to take breaks. And he came back with mud on his boots. That made my skin crawl. I asked Joe if he ever said anything about the trail. And Joe, wide-eyed, said yeah. Rick mentioned it once in passing. Said it was a good place to clear your head. Clear your head. Jesus Christ. I needed more. So I checked property records. Bank records. Anything I could find. I got creative. I posed as a guy interested in selling Rick a classic truck. Used that to get his email address. From there, I hacked his Venmo history. Not proud of that. But what I found, he'd made a payment on February 13th, 2017, right around 3:17 p.m., to a burner account with the memo, "Thanks for the help." That was it. That was my tipping point. I sat in my garage, staring at that screen, and every cell in my body screamed, "It's him." But here's the thing, I still had no proof. Not real proof. No DNA. No video. No confession. Just gut. Just pattern recognition. Just obsession. I recorded an episode of my podcast that night. I didn't name him, but I described him. I described the man who lives among us. The man who hides in the ordinary. The man who wears the mask of normalcy so well, you'll invite him into your life and never think twice. And you know what happened? The next day, the episode was pulled from my platform. Flagged. Reported. Then the phone call started. At first, just heavy breathing. Then clicks. Then a muffled voice. "You're looking too close." It was enough to shake me, but not enough to stop me. I doubled down. Sent anonymous tips to the tip line. Shared everything with a contact I had at the state police. But they were radio silent. Until October 2022. The press release dropped like a thunderclap. Arrest made in Delphi murders. And the name? Richard Allen. My hands shook as I read it. I couldn't breathe. It felt like every nerve in my body was short-circuiting. He confessed to being there. Said he took them down the hill. Just like the recording. But then, as if trying to minimize it, he called himself a witness, not a killer. Said he didn't know what happened after. Bull. Fucking. Shit. They had more. A sealed affidavit. Evidence the public didn't get to see. Whispers of ritual elements. A signature. A pattern. Maybe even a second man. The mask was off now. And what lay beneath it was worse than we imagined. He had been there the whole time. Living in plain sight. Laughing at us. Watching us dig through the dirt while he sipped coffee behind a cash register. This was never just a murder. It was a performance. And he'd fooled us all. Until now. Chapter 4. The cracks in the community. There's a kind of silence that falls over a town when the boogeyman finally gets a name. It isn't relief. Not right away. It's not even justice. It's confusion. It's betrayal. It's a stunned, sickening hush. As if the soul of the town itself had been sucker punched and didn't know how to breathe anymore. When news broke that Richard Allen, the quiet man from CVS, the guy who rang you up for shampoo and allergy meds, had been arrested for the murders of Abby and Libby, the shockwave split Delphi in half. Some people celebrated. They lit candles in the park, clutched each other through tears, murmured finally, like a prayer. Others couldn't believe it. Refused to. "Rick? No way. He's a good guy. He's always been polite. Are they sure they've got the right man?" That second group, they were louder than you'd expect. Louder than they had any right to be. I watched it all unravel from the sidelines, like a man with a front row seat to the collapse of a civilization made of cornfields and polite smiles. The town meetings turned ugly. Neighbors started avoiding each other at church. People who had known each other for decades stopped waving from their porches. And beneath all of it, deeper and darker than anyone wanted to admit, was the question nobody wanted to say out loud. Who else knew? Because once you accept that the killer lived among you for 5 years, it's only a short, terrifying leap to suspect that maybe, just maybe, he didn't act alone. That's when the cracks truly began to widen. Whispers started cropping up everywhere. Online first, of course. Reddit threads exploded with speculation. There has to be a second man. The crime scene was too staged, too complex. Richard Allen doesn't strike me as a guy who could pull this off alone. And the kicker? Why did it take 5 years to arrest him if he was right there the whole time? It didn't take long before names started flying. Local men, teachers, pastors, old high school bullies, the guy who used to coach soccer and moved away right after the murders, the volunteer firefighter who always seemed a little too interested in the case, a retired cop who was rumored to have been on the trail that day but never admitted it publicly. The town turned on itself. Paranoia set in like mold in the walls, slow, toxic, hard to get rid of. Families who used to vacation together were suddenly whispering behind closed doors. Parents watched their kids' teachers with narrowed eyes. Former friends were unfriended. The local Facebook group became a battlefield. And through it all, I watched. I recorded. I documented. But I also felt it, deep in my gut. The guilt. The dread. The awful, gnawing truth that maybe I had made things worse. Because after Rick's arrest, people started looking at me differently. I got congratulated in whispers. You were right. You always knew. You called it. And yeah, part of me wanted to scream, I fucking told you. But another part, the darker, more honest part, knew I hadn't caught a killer. I just torn the skin off a wound that never got the chance to heal. Some people thanked me. Others blamed me. There was a woman, Tina, whose husband I'd publicly speculated about in my podcast 2 years earlier. She saw me in the grocery store and slapped me. No warning. Just rage and grief and shame all wrapped up in one shaky hand. I didn't even raise mine in defense. I let her hit me. Because maybe I deserved it. I'd gone from reporter to vigilante to town pariah. I was no longer part of Delphi. I was its ghost. The man who wouldn't let the town forget. The one who dragged skeletons out of closets, even if they were just dusty coats. And the worst part, the nightmares were getting worse. In them, I was always on the bridge, always hearing that voice, down the hill. But now, in the dream, I followed it. I went down the hill, and I saw the girls. I saw the killer. I saw his face. And sometimes, when I woke up, that face wasn't Rick's. It was mine. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't function. I started drinking again. I told myself it was just to sleep, just to take the edge off. But we both know that's bullshit. The weight of everything, the deaths, the obsession, the arrest, the fallout was crushing me. And then, to make it worse, rumors started about a sealed affidavit. That law enforcement had more evidence they weren't sharing. That the crime scene may have had ritualistic elements. Symbols. Candles. Posed bodies. Suddenly, people weren't just talking about a killer. They were talking about a cult. A ring. A network. Some of it felt like conspiracy nonsense. But some of it, I don't know. Some of it felt too possible. Because when you've spent 5 years obsessed with a case like this, you learn something awful about people. There are no limits to what they can hide. I started revisiting old interviews, old case notes, trying to fit new puzzle pieces into the old frame. There were inconsistencies, gaps, people who said they saw things but later retracted, rumors of a second car at the trailhead, eyewitnesses who remembered hearing voices, multiple voices, not just a man and a boy, or a man and a younger man. I started chasing shadows again. Even after Rick was behind bars, I couldn't stop. Because the truth, the part one didn't want to say out loud, I didn't believe it was over. And worse, I don't think they did either. Libby's sister, Kelsey, she posted something cryptic online not long after the arrest. We're thankful for movement in the case. But we're not done yet. Not done yet. What the hell did that mean? Was there more? Was someone still out there? Still watching? Still waiting? I didn't know. But I felt it. In the pit of my stomach. In the whisper of leaves outside my window at 3 a.m. In the way my dog barked at nothing some nights. In the click on the other end of my phone line when I answered, and no one spoke. And then one day, an envelope arrived on my doorstep. No return address. No handwriting. Just a flash drive. Inside, a single audio file. For seconds long. Two words. Not down the hill. Something worse. You're next. Chapter 5, The Verdict. They say justice is supposed to feel like relief. They lie. I thought that the day of the verdict would be the climax of my story. The final page, the closing credits, the moment the weight of 5 years lifted from my chest and let me finally fucking breathe. But the truth, it didn't feel like freedom. It felt like walking out of a burning house with nothing left but ash in your lungs. The trial of Richard Allen didn't begin like some dramatic courtroom drama on TV. No gasps, no surprise witnesses, just long, grueling hours of testimony, experts, photos, and silence, so much silence. But inside that silence, inside those raw details spilled on the record, we were finally handed the full shape of the horror we'd all tried to forget. Day one of the trial felt like being dragged backward through glass. The prosecution laid it out slowly, piece by awful piece. The Snapchat data, the time-stamped audio, the fiber and DNA traces, Libby's bravery in hitting record, Abby's broken glasses, the positioning of their bodies, the patterns, the staging, and when the sealed affidavit was finally unsealed to the public, it was worse than anything I imagined. There were signs of control, posing, symbols carved into trees near the bodies. One of the investigators, voice trembling, read out a line Rick had allegedly written in a journal they recovered. I took their power. I was God for 43 minutes. 43 fucking minutes. I wanted to vomit. And then, there was the confession. Not a full one. Not the kind that gives you everything. But enough. He admitted to being on the trail. Admitted to seeing the girls. Admitted to telling them to go down the hill. He tried to say he didn't kill them. That someone else was there. A shadow figure. An accomplice. A ghost. The defense latched onto it. Argued there wasn't enough physical evidence. That he'd been coerced, that someone else had been pulling the strings, but the jury wasn't swayed. How could they be? Libby's phone had done what no one else could. It saw through the mask. I watched from the gallery every single day. I sat beside Abby's uncle, who clutched a rosary so hard it left imprints in his palm. I sat behind Libby's mom, who didn't cry, she just stared ahead like she'd already buried every tear. And I sat there shaking, not out of fear, not even out of rage. I was shaking because the thing that had consumed my life for 5 years was finally being dragged into the light. The voice. The bridge. The whisper. It was real. And it had a face now. I kept waiting to feel something. Closure. Triumph. Peace. But all I felt was exhaustion. Like I'd run a marathon barefoot through broken glass and realized the finish line didn't lead anywhere. Then came the final day. The jury deliberated for less than 3 hours. When they returned and the foreman stood, the entire room held its breath. Even Rick, sitting there in that ill-fitting suit, still pretending to be small, harmless, looked like he knew it was over. On the count of murder in the first degree, we find the defendant guilty. And just like that, it was done. He was sentenced to 130 years in prison. No possibility of parole. No second chances. They led him away in cuffs, and I swear to God he smirked. That little fucking smirk. Like he was proud. Like he still thought he had some kind of power. But then I saw something shift in his eyes. Just for a second. When Libby's grandfather stood and shouted, "You don't get to win." That was the moment Rick's face cracked. That was the moment the monster became a man again. Small. Pathetic. Caged. We all sat in that courtroom long after he was gone. Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. It was like we were afraid to break the spell. Like if we stood up, the nightmare might start again. Eventually, I walked outside into the sunlight. It was warm. Unfairly warm. The kind of day that feels too good for what it follows. Reporters were everywhere. Microphones. Cameras. Satellite trucks. The circus had arrived, 5 years too late. I gave one interview. Just one. They asked me what it felt like, after everything, to be right. And I said, "It doesn't feel like I was right. It feels like we all lost. And now we finally know how much." That quote went viral, got clipped and posted everywhere. But what they didn't hear, what I didn't say, is that part of me still didn't feel like it was over. Because Rick's confession, what little he gave, kept referencing someone else. I wasn't alone. They told me what to do. She said they wouldn't get hurt. Who the hell was she? Was it just the ramblings of a sick man trying to avoid death? Maybe. Or maybe, just maybe, the cracks in this case go deeper than any of us realized. I still get the calls, the emails, tips, people whispering about other suspects, cops from neighboring counties asking for files, parents in town quietly asking if they should still lock their doors. It hasn't gone away, but I have. I left Delphi 3 months after the verdict, sold the house, shut down the podcast, burned every photo I'd taped to my garage wall, because I couldn't carry it anymore. I drive now, across the country, just me and the road. No deadlines. No strings. I pull over in small towns, drink shitty diner coffee, and sleep in cheap motels. I keep my face off the internet. I pay cash. People think I'm running. I'm not. I'm remembering how to breathe. I still hear the voice sometimes, down the hill, but it's quieter now. Not gone. Not forgotten. Just quieter. And every once in a while, I drive to a bridge. Not the bridge, but one like it. I stand at the edge, feel the wind, and I whisper their names out loud. Abby. Libby. It's not enough, but it's something.